This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. When you ask people to name the kingdoms, most people get the big ones. Animals, plants, bacteria. Some people may even come up with the protists. But there is one more. Here's a hint. Yeast are part of it. So are shiitakes. Are you getting it? Well, the answer is fungi, or perhaps I should say fungi. We'll come up with that answer sometime during the hour, too. But either way you say it, members of this kingdom are everywhere, from the produce aisle of the supermarket to your backyard to in between your toes. Experts say there are more than a million species of fungi on the planet, and we've only discovered 5% or so. So this hour, we salute you, fungi, from the macro, the ones you find on your steak or in your sandwich, to the micro, the ones that cause illness and disease. It's all things fungal this hour. Oh, I can hear a new show on NPR. Anyway, now let me introduce my first two guests. Kathy Hodge is Associate Professor of Mycology at Cornell University. She joins us from a studio on the campus in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hodge.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joe.
And my other guest to start off with is David Fisher. He's a mycologist, and we'll get him to explain exactly what that means at some point. And the author of Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America, he joins us from the studios of WAER in Syracuse, New York. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Joe. Good afternoon.
So this is All Things Fungal, and if you want to join the call, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And we would also be interested in hearing from you if you're listening or joining people on the Science Island in Second Life. And we'll maybe try and take some of your calls from there as well. But let's start with you, Dr. Hodge, and give us some definitions. What's a fungus?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. That's a tough one.
Oh, darn. I thought I was pitching the easy one first.
Well, I used to teach that a fungus was heterotrophic, right?
Uh-oh.
Can't make its own food.
Yeah.
So no photosynthesis going on here.
Right.
They're filamentous, usually, so they're kind of fuzzy little things. They make spores, and like us, they're eukaryotic. So they have a nucleus and mitochondria inside their cells.
Okay. So what you used to say that.
Yeah, because there's all these exceptions. You know, we just talked about yeasts on this show, and they're yep. unicellular for the most part. Fungi can do lots of different things, and they include everything from mushrooms to yeasts to the mold growing on your shower curtain.
Uh-huh. And filamentous, why would that be a requirement, as you were starting to say? I mean, I presume filamentous means to normal people what it means to what do you call yourselves, mycologists or?
We are mycologists.
Okay. So, yes. So does a filamentous mean the same thing? Is it just something that's sort of stringy?
Yeah, it's sort of stringy. So, but the shell, the cells themselves are actually shaped like little tiny threads, almost too small to actually see. But inside those tiny threads is where the cells of the fungi are.
Uh-huh.
And they grow outwards at the tips.
And so give me a little clue about, I mean, we were hearing, yes, as you mentioned, we talked earlier in the day with about yeast and whether they reproduce sexually or asexually. And, you know, without being getting us into trouble with the FCC, can you tell us how yeast reproduce?
Well, yeah, most fungi are capable of either having sex and having sexual offspring, or they can make spores asexually just by budding off little pieces of themselves.
And
most fungi can do it either way.
Right. And so in a fungal world, what does having sex mean?
Well, let me see. How can I?
I think we could probably – I have a feeling it has to do with exchanging DNA rather than other things.
That's right. You go to a bar. You meet a compatible fungus. You
this is no fair. I'm
get
supposed
together.
To make the jokes. Okay, so seriously.
So seriously, yes, fungi can have sex.
Really?
Two compatible fungi get together. They swap nuclei. Their nuclei recombine and go through meiosis in much the same way that human nuclei go through meiosis during mating. And the offspring are haploid products of meiosis. So each offspring of sexual reproduction is genetically different from its parents.
Okay. All right. So, David Fisher, how important is sexual reproduction or asexual reproduction in the world of edible mushrooms?
Well, mushrooms, in particular, are all reproductive structures, more specifically sexual reproductive structures. Everything that we would call a mushroom is a sexual reproductive structure.
Huh. And so tell me, okay, so what? How do you define what a mushroom is as opposed to some other kind of fungus? Does it have special properties that we can identify?
Well, a mushroom essentially is used as a term for, macroscopic sexual reproducing fungi, particularly to the fruiting bodies, which is basically a synonym for mushroom. If it produces a mushroom, a macroscopic structure specifically for sexual reproduction, then we would call that a mushroom. And we also would term the whole organism a mushroom.
Huh. So, I'm sorry. So the spongy outer part of this fruiting body, this mushroom, the part that we actually wind up eating, is that mostly protein or is it sugars or what's that made up of? Cells?
Well, it's all cellular. It's all hyphal. It's all filamentous, as Kathy noted. The cells are essentially the same. All the cells in the mushrooms, in the mushroom or the fruiting body, are the same. The magic happens on little cells called basidia, or in little tubular cells called acai.
Uh-huh. And magic.
That's where the sexual process of meiosis and mitosis and karyogamy and all that exciting stuff happens.
I got it. And so you are focused on these edible mushrooms. What's the difference? Non-edible mushroom, one is, I presume, that doesn't taste good and B, that can make you sick. But what are the qualities that an edible mushroom brings that makes people eat them? Are they nutritious? Are they healthful in some way? Why would people eat mushrooms? Why do they start eating fungus?
Well, a big part of the answer to that, Joe, is that mushrooms, as a rule, have a wide assortment of proteins and amino acids. In fact, because of that fact, that they're so loaded with amino acids and a variety of amino acids, that gives them a savory flavor. And it makes them, for example, an ideal food for vegetarians who don't get any animal protein in their diet. Fungi are very helpful from a nutritional aspect for vegetarians in particular.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's take some calls now. And as I said, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go first to Paul in Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Joe Palka.
Hello.
I have an amazing story to tell you, and maybe I can get an explanation from the conversation today.
That's what we're here for.
Wonderful. We live in a region just south of us, the South Ozarks region, where we do a lot of rafting and canoeing. And after getting off of the river, looking for firewood just after dark, a little moonlight, my buddy stepped on a log. And the log crumpled into particulates that glowed in a green phosphorescence. If you look at a fire, and it's, glows in a kind of a red tone, it was identical to that, but it was green. It was scary. At first, really, to be honest with you, as kids, we were like, what is this?
Wow.
And, he took the log and heaved it over the mountainside, and it crumpled, down the cliffside and in through the trees, and it was just a shower of, glowing green. I called it phosphorescence. It's
okay,
like a lightning bug.
Well, Paul, let's see if you've given enough indication to get Kathy Hodge or David Fisher to identify that for you.
Yes, sir.
Kathy,
that sounds really cool, Paul. That's something we call foxfire, and foxfire, that can be produced by fungi. So probably what you had there was a log colonized by a mushroom, maybe an armillaria, a honey mushroom. And mm-hmm. the mycelium of that mushroom grows throughout the log and, for reasons we don't understand, makes this beautiful glow, bioluminescence.
Yes, that's what I wish we understood that, because I've done my research and have never found the answer. It was amazing, you guys. You just can't believe it unless you were there. It
wow.
was unbelievable.
Wow. Paul, thanks for that that story. It sounds remarkable. Let's take another call now from Sylvia in Long Island, New York. Sylvia, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. When I was in college, I don't know if this was something that they said because they were having fun with mushrooms, but they said that mushrooms came from outer space, and I was just wondering if that's the case.
Well, what about that, David Fisher? Do you buy that theory? I guess it goes back to panspermia we were also talking about earlier today.
Right. I haven't seen personally good evidence that makes a believer out of me of the idea that a fungal spore could survive a trip through space. I wouldn't categorically rule it out, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Spores, some spores have pretty good longevity, viability to be able to germinate, but it just doesn't seem very practical to me. But again, I can't rule it out. I just don't know.
No, it's an interesting one. One final call before we have to take a break, and let's go to Kevin in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Hi there. How are you folks today?
Good.
So I wanted to mention that there is a fellow named Tom Michaels in Kingston, Tennessee, who is successfully cultivating the black Perigo truffle.
Really? Mm-hmm. Really?
And he's only been going at it for about 3 years now, so the supplies are still extremely limited, but he's selling them to, you know, three-star restaurants in New York and Atlanta and Chicago.
Interesting. Kevin, let me see. David, do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. Growing the Perigord truffle on the roots of filbert trees. It's a symbiotic relationship, as many mushrooms have with various plant species, trees in particular. A gentleman in North Carolina named Franklin Garland pioneered this technique. To the best of my understanding, from what I've seen, the money so far is not in the crop, but in selling the inoculated trees. Now,
okay,
whether it
David,
might get to a point.
David, I'm sorry. We have to take a short break. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. But we'll have more about truffles and other members of the fungal kingdom when we come back after this short break. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about fungi, or fungi, with my guests Kathy Hodge, Associate Professor of Mycology at Cornell University, and David Fisher. He's a mycologist and author of Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America. Now, those are the big guys, but last year, big guys in terms of size, the mushrooms of the fungal world, but last year the American Academy of Microbiology decided that the fungi were not getting enough attention, not because people don't like mushrooms, but because research on fungi and fungal diseases, they argued, has been seriously neglected. And as a result, we humans and even plants and animals were becoming increasingly susceptible to the devastating effects of some fungi. So they did what scientists do. They organized a colloquium, and the nation's leading experts on fungi gathered in Tucson to plan their strategy, a way to get people to pay more attention to fungi. Well, joining me now to talk more about that is my guest, Arturo Casadevall. He's the chairman of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's also former head of infectious diseases there. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Casadevall.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. And by the way, oh, I'm sorry, if you want to talk to us, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. So I guess the first question was the colloquium a success, and are people paying more attention?
Oh, I think it was a success. Just the fact that you are calling me is an indication that I think that we have connected in making the public and other scientists more aware of the importance of the medical fungi.
So can you give me some idea of the fungal diseases that affect humans? I don't think people, I mean, they maybe have heard of athlete's foot or something like that, but maybe there's more serious things out there that they don't know about.
Right. I think most people are familiar with athlete's foot and with the nail fungi. But I think what people are not that are aware of is that, especially in hospitalized patients, that we are having an epidemic of fungal diseases, including, for example, infections with candida albicans and other species of candida, which can go to practically any organ.
And what are the symptoms of candida?
Well, the symptoms of candida are similar to the symptoms of other types of infections. You get fever, you get redness, you get... But these tend to often, when they affect the internal organs, they are life-threatening. You know, athlete's foot doesn't kill you, but certainly fungal diseases that are systemic are often lethal.
And are there antifungal drugs in the same sense that there are antibacterial drugs that are very effective?
Yes, there are, but there is a big difference. We don't have that many. The treatment for these diseases often requires prolonged therapy, and by prolonged I mean many months, and they often don't work as well. So from the point of view of therapy, we do have therapy, but the therapy is not as good as we would like it to be.
So is fungal research being vigorously supported by the federal government, or not enough, or is there a need for more? And are the pharmaceutical companies interested because of the prevalence of these diseases?
I mean, I think the answer is that we all feel that there should be more. In reality, the government has supported fungal research. The problem has been that if, in contrast to viruses and bacteria and parasites, these fields are small, and there are relatively few investigators trying to deal with what is in an entire kingdom. And so the problem is that it's not that it has not been funded, but that the amount of research that is going on is relatively small, relative to the problem.
Now, we've been talking about the potential threat that certain fungi present to human health, but I gather that fungi have been implicated in several recent die-offs in other species: frogs, bees in the bee population that was devastated, even the bat die-offs that have been occurring in New York State. Is that your understanding as well?
That's right. I mean, what has happened to the amphibians is a catastrophe. In the last 20 years or so, a new fungus appeared to have come out of nowhere and has led to the extinction, and I underline the word extinction, of entire species of frogs. Before this happened, we did not think that a single infectious disease could wipe out a species. And so this fungus is making its way around the world, and it continues to be a problem that may be made worse by global warming. And now, as you mentioned, and I believe there was a program by NPR, the bats in the Northeast appear to be infected with this white nose fungus. We don't really know what's going on there, but we're having major fungal bat die-offs.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
And just finally, your report also talked about a rather scary scenario of possibly having fungi of some sort used as a bioterrorism weapon. I mean, presumably, I guess you're thinking it could be used against us. Is that a real threat?
Well, fungi have always been known to be major pathogens of plants. And there is already a lot of concern that they could be used to destroy agriculture. But interestingly, they have gotten almost no attention as to biological weapons against humans and against animals. And I certainly don't want to give anyone any ideas, but I just want to point out that this is an enormous kingdom with 1.5 million species. That is, many of these are easily available. The spores are very stable. And some of us are very concerned that many of these species have the potential to be major biological weapons.
Hmm. Well, if that doesn't get people's attention, I expect, a few things would. That's a rather interesting and perhaps alarming scenario. But in any case, Dr. Arturo Casadevall, thank you very much for coming on and talking about this with us today.
You're very welcome. book.
Dr. Casadevall is the chairman of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's also a former head of infectious diseases there. And now we're going to turn back to more of the macro world, although we can still talk about microfungi or microfungal organisms, if you like. We're talking with Kathy Hodge. She's an associate professor of mycology at Cornell University, and David Fisher is a mycologist and the author of Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America. And Kathy Hodge, I just wonder, what did you think of Dr. Casadevall's comments about the potential terrorist threat of fungi?
Well, I think he raises some very important points, and we've also got to think about the biosecurity of our crops. I'd hate to have a crop wiped out by bioterrorism by introducing a new plant pathogen.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Well, we're also taking calls from 800-989-8255, and let's take another call now from John in Hyattsville, Maryland. John, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Dr. Hodge and David, this is John Elfritz from Moss.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
We had David Fisher as our guest mycologist previously on our fall forays in Pennsylvania.
What did you say the name of your group was?
MAW, uh-huh. Mycological Association of Washington.
Oh, there you go.
And anyway, I'm going to be giving a talk to the Western Pennsylvania Mushroom Club a week from tomorrow on what is a species and should I care. And in doing a lot of reading in genetics and evolution, I've sort of come to the conclusion that even though fungi have been described for the last 200 or 300 years mainly on the basis of structure, that the biological definition, at least the variation that two compatible individuals that produce viable offspring in the wild, it seems to me the most objective one. But in recent years, DNA sequencing has been used to a great extent to, at least as a means of confirming or denying or rearranging relationships among different groups of fungi.
So
can it be considered as more accurate as a means of defining species without using far more DNA sequences from different areas?
Kathy Hodge, what about that? This is sort of what's a species in the fungal world? What does it mean?
Well, it's a really good question, and species concepts are a really hot area of study right now. And again, I wish I could give you a simple answer, but people have written entire books about different species concepts. So John mentioned the biological species concept. You know, if two things can mate and produce a viable offspring, they must belong to the same species. But more recently, we've been looking at fungal DNA and deciding what's a fungal species by looking at kind of a historical approach, looking at the lineage of a fungus. So defining species by their history rather than by what they can happen to do right now. And an example that might be more familiar to you guys is orchids. You can take orchids that belong to two different genera and hybridize them and produce viable offspring, but nobody would argue that those two parents are really the same species because they're dramatically different. So there's some conflict between those two species concepts that we're still straightening out.
Okay. Well, that's thank you for that call, John. Let's go now to Sky in San Antonio, Texas. Sky, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have so many things on my mind, but let me just rattle off a couple things here, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay.
The first thing is that I'm getting ready to go vegetarian, and I want to know if processed mushrooms, does the processing destroy the nutritive value of them? Am I better off eating fresh? The second thing I wanted to know is, are they a separate kingdom or phylum? I mean, are they, they're not animals, obviously, but they don't seem to be plants. I've heard that there are some slime molds that are ambulatory, And so I was wondering if one of your guests could possibly say something about that as well.
Okay, Sky, thank you for that. I'm a little terrified by ambulatory slime molds, but but let's start with the first question, and maybe David Fisher, processed mushrooms, I presume that means cultivated versus wild ones that you would pick in the wild. Is there a nutritional difference?
Well, I think actually I interpreted his question as implying, you know, cooking, canning, freezing, sorts of things.
Okay, well, let's answer it that way.
Well, the shortest answer is that generally speaking, we do not recommend that mushrooms be eaten raw. They have to be cooked, generally speaking. Personally, I won't even eat, the white grocery store button mushrooms cooked raw because there's a substance in there. And more research needs to be done regarding this substance, agaritine, which has been shown to have at least some carcinogenic potentials. So I'm a little bit nervous about that.
But cooking breaks down agaritine?
Right. And it also breaks down some amino acids, some proteins, into simpler forms. There are a lot of wild mushrooms, for example, black morels, morels in general, which cause people severe gastrointestinal upset. I won't go into details.
Thank you.
If they're eaten raw, but if they're eaten, after thorough cooking, then they're fine and they're scrumptious and they're wonderful.
Well, we're talking about mushrooms as members of the fungal community and as they stand alone or as they're cooked in butter. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, maybe we should get to this because it's obviously going to come up as a point. People are wise to be cautious about picking up mushrooms that they see in the woods and even cooking them and eating them. You've got to know what you're doing in this world, I presume.
Oh, absolutely. It's, I like to compare it to parachuting. You know, packing your own chute or using dynamite to blow up that old stump in your backyard. One mistake may be your last. We can't stress the importance of proper identification of a mushroom carefully enough. People poison themselves all the time with mushrooms by doing things like matching the picture to their specimen, and they want the mushroom that they've found to be a morel or to be a chanterelle. And if they will it to be, then it ends up in their sauté pan. And it very well may be another bioluminescent mushroom, for example, the jack-o'-lantern, which a lot of people poison themselves with thinking that they've found chanterelles.
Yeah. So care is needed. But it is possible. I mean, you can teach yourself to properly skydive. So I presume that, people who buy your book about the wild mushrooms, at least in cooking them, you're not advocating that they – go find them and cook them. You're advocating that they cook them after somebody else has found them for them?
No, presuming that there is a reasonable level of literacy on the part of the person with the book in their hand, whether they're using Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America or the Audubon Society Field Guide or Mushrooms Demystified or any of the other great mushroom books that are available, the importance is to make sure that you are thorough in the identification process and that you rule out other possibilities. For example, one thing we typically do with the mushroom is sever the cap from the stalk, put the cap on a piece of white paper. Actually, I like clear plastic, and see what color the spores are. And when people skip that process with a gilled mushroom in particular, they're courting danger.
Okay. Let's take another call now from Kim in New Braunfels, Texas. Kim, welcome to the program.
Yes. Just kind of a comment, and then maybe your guest could comment on it. It seems so far fungi have been getting a little bit of a bad rap, and I just wanted maybe him to point out the benefits of some, like the mycorrhizal fungi, that is very, very beneficial in agriculture and when people are making compost piles and what have you. If he could comment on that, and I will listen off the air.
Okay, thanks. If it's all right with you, I'm going to direct that question to Kathy Hodge. Fungi that are good and useful, because I certainly didn't set this show up to make an attack on fungi. Please don't think that.
Well, we've already talked about yeast, so we know some of the goodness of fungi already. But Kim's right. There are very many fungi that do a lot of good for us, and she mentioned mycorrhizal fungi, which are the fungi that are associated with the roots of plants and trees and help the plants and trees gather nutrients and really support their growth. They're really essential for forests, mm-hmm. and you'd be hard-pressed to find a plant that doesn't have a fungal partner working with it. Some other good fungi that I can think of are ones that we use industrially to make things we like to eat. So if you're drinking a Sprite right now, you're probably drinking a fungal product. The citric acid is mostly produced from fungi.
Okay.
So lots of good things to say.
Good. Well, we'll come back and have lots more good things to say, but we have to take a short break. Please stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about fungi. My guests are Kathy Hodge, Associate Professor of Mycology at Cornell University, David Fisher. He's a mycologist and author of Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. And we're also taking questions from people listening or joining the show. I don't know what the right verb is, actually, from Second Life, but I wanted to introduce a Second Life question here from Bjorlin Loon, who writes, I heard a giant fungus underground in Oregon was the largest living thing on Earth. Is that true, Kathy Hodge?
Could be true. The humongous fungus. We've got a few contenders for the humongous fungus,
uh-huh.
but
mm-hmm.
yeah, there's one out west, and I don't recall its actual size. But
right. but how big are we? How big approximately are we talking about? I mean, these feet, yards, miles.
We're talking about acres, like acres. Hundreds of acres.
Wow.
So this is a fungal mycelium that grows in the forest floor and attacks the roots of trees as it grows. It's a honey mushroom, Armillaria. And this single individual of a mushroom species covers an area hundreds of acres in diameter.
All right.
Pretty awesome.
Wow. Let's take another question from that domain from SpaceXcape Bridges at the Science Friday Island, who asks, do fungi have roots or fungi have roots? And David Fisher, I guess you sort of went at this question, but what's the answer there?
Well, Kathy sort of inferred it in her answer to the last question.
Mm-hmm.
A mushroom is the fruiting body. When you pick up a mushroom, for example, that you see on the forest floor growing from a log, you're essentially doing the equivalent of pulling an apple from a tree. You're not removing the organism. The mushroom, the fruiting body, is not the organism.
Mm-hmm.
The thallus, the body of that organism, remains in that rotten log or down in the soil, perhaps wrapped around the roots of trees in the case of a mycorrhizal fungus.
Right.
So if you want to call it roots,
they're not roots. Yeah, I guess it's a different word. But there's something that's growing underneath the thing that looks like the fruiting body.
Right. We call that the mycelium.
Okay.
And that is the thallus, the body, if you will.
Excellent. Okay, well, we're going to move on slightly, although we're staying with fungi. My next guest is not a mycologist. She's an entomologist, and she's been studying the Asian longhorn beetle, an invasive insect that's found a new home here in the U.S. The beetle makes its living eating trees, healthy maple trees, in fact. But just how the beetle digests all that wood isn't clear, or at least it wasn't clear until recently when researchers discovered that the beetle has a fungal companion, a microscopic ally that does a lot of the heavy lifting, or I guess you'd think of it as heavy digesting for the insect. And joining me now to talk more about that is Kelly Hoover. She's an associate professor of entomology at Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania. Dr. Hoover, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So, you're studying this beetle that's eating trees. What led you to the possibility that a fungus was involved here?
Well, we just started to look. There hadn't been anybody looking except for bacteria, and we decided to start sequencing what was inside the gut and discovered that there was a fungus that we found in every specimen we looked at, including beetles we collected out of trees in New York City. And lo and behold, it's the same fungus. And it's a common fungus that you find all over the place, Fusarium salani. It's a species complex, so there are many, many species within that complex. And this one happens to be unique. It sort of lines up with a few related Fusarium, but it seems to be novel.
And this particular Fusarium is capable of digesting wood?
We believe that it does. We've been looking for, well, what our paper showed was that when wood goes into the beetle and comes out the other end, the lignin in the wood has actually been degraded. And that had never been shown before for any insect, even termites. We also did look at a termite and found that they can do it too, but the method to be able to prove that this is actually happening had not been done before on insects. So what we found with this fungus is that it's producing enzymes that we believe are capable of helping to digest the wood.
Really? And how does this differ? I mean, we've heard about, we've been talking in this hour about fungus forming symbiotic relationships with other organisms. What's the good relationship between the fungus, I mean, for the fungus, not for the tree, of course, but the relationship between the fungus and the beetle?
Well, I suspect for the fungus, what it gets out of it is that it gets moved around from tree to tree. I suspect what the beetle's getting out of it is assistance in breaking down wood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful symbiotic relationship. This insect has been encountering related fungi for probably thousands of years, maybe millions of years, and it makes sense that why not have it live inside your gut and take it with you?
Sure, why not? Well,
I mean, there are other termites, for example, that cultivate fungal combs outside their body or grow fungus gardens.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's how they are able to break down woody material. This guy decided to have the fungus live inside of him.
Hmm. Now, we've been talking about the sort of the negative consequences of this beetle having shown up and the threat it poses for trees. But I gather there's another way to turn this around and think, well, gosh, this may turn out to be a useful fungus to have stumbled across. Can you explain about that?
Sure. One of the things that we're very interested in is, you know, sort of bioprospecting for new enzymes that can be used in biofuels production. So this fungus may very well turn out to be a good source for those kinds of enzymes because, you know, with wood, you know, to make cellulosic ethanol, the lignin in the wood is like this binding adhesive matrix that holds all the cellulose together and makes it inaccessible to getting to the cellulose, which is the part that you want to make ethanol. So if you can get rid of the lignin in a nice, safe way, the problem with getting rid of lignin is the way it's done now is you have to use high temperatures and nasty chemicals. But in biological systems, this beetle has evolved a way to do it fairly rapidly and in a nice microenvironment, if you will. Maybe we can figure out a way to get to grow those enzymes outside of the insect.
There you
go. And we may have some application for biofuel.
The silver lining to an apparently dark cloud.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, Kelly Hoover, it's a very interesting story. Thanks for coming on and sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
Kelly Hoover is an associate professor of entomology at Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania. We've been talking this hour, about larger members of the fungal family. My guests are Kathy Hodge. She's an associate professor of mycology at Cornell University. And David Fisher is the author of Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America. And let's take another call now and go to Steve in Wilmington, North Carolina. Steve, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. And I want you first to know how thoroughly I enjoy Science Friday.
Oh, good.
I look forward to it every week.
Well,
part of my quote was, by the earlier gentleman regarding the edibility and nutrition content of mushrooms. Now, I'm trying to understand on the edibility of some of the mushrooms. I hear this. Is it true or is it just a fable about a death ring on the stem or the stalk if you're trying to pick them in the wild to taste or try or whatever? Is it notorious that all poisonous mushrooms have this death ring, and or if they do not have it, is it still safe? Is there any sense to all this?
Rule of thumb. Okay, let's ask David Fisher for his views on that.
Yeah, well, there are no safe, simple rules of thumb. There are a bunch of folk myths. One is that if you cook a mushroom with a silver coin or a silver spoon, if it's a poisonous mushroom, that silver will become tarnished. That's just an example. Or that all mushrooms that grow on wood are safe. None of those principles work. The bottom line is, just as with a berry, you have to identify the thing first, and then you can find out what human experience with it is. And, of course, in a lot of cases, with a lot of mushrooms that aren't so common, aren't so conspicuous, or perhaps don't look so appealing from a culinary perspective, we don't know what their edibility versus toxicity is at this point. We're always looking for testers.
I see. sounds a little gruesome, actually. I hope they volunteer.
I hope there's
informed consent. Yes, exactly. I should point out that on the ScienceFriday.com website, there's a really excellent video that'll show you, if you don't happen to have your own field guide, you can go see a videotape that's there by Flora Lichtman about a trip to the New York Botanical Gardens, where you can see some pretty interesting examples of mushrooms that are growing in the wild. But again, caution is the key word here, I think, in terms of any kind of dining experience based on things you find as you're wandering through the fields.
Absolutely.
Let's take another call now. Let's take another call now and go to Ann. I'm sorry, Ann in Austin, Texas.
Hi. How are y'all today?
I'm good.
Good. I'm calling, and I'm really glad y'all had this discussion today, and I'm really interested in mushrooms and pets and being outside. I had a pet not too long ago that had a brush with death, very close to death. The vet could not even find I believe the liver count was high, I think, or low. I'm not sure exactly what it was.
Something bad.
It was something bad, right. Yeah, and the dog was not going to make it. Mm. And the only thing that we could figure out was in the back, about this time every year, this type of mushroom would grow in the back of the yard. And he had had a dog before, died from the same thing. And so, and fortunately, the dog came back. I think it just actually seemed as though, and it's kind of funny, but had like a really bad trip on a mushroom.
Uh-oh. Well, I knew we'd get there someplace. Okay.
I mean, really bad, but it came back. And we kind of took the, and I was real surprised that the vet really didn't know what to, you know, I was just thinking that this could be a problem for other pets in the neighborhood or just around, you know, animals out eating just these different mushrooms and them not understanding what or how to treat that and maybe got a bad vet.
Interesting, interesting problem there, and thank you for identifying that. Kathy Hodges, is there anything you can do first response if that sort of thing happens?
Yeah, that's a tough one, and since we have a big vet school here at Cornell, I've actually seen three mushroom poisonings this summer with dogs, two of them fatal. And dogs also can be poisoned by mushrooms. And the tricky part with dogs, well, I guess there's two tricky parts. One is that they can't tell you what they ate. So you have to kind of infer what they have, or you end up looking at vomit specimens, which I personally prefer not to do. The other problem with dogs is that we don't have much information about the effects of poison mushrooms on dogs.
Right.
So they can be poisoned by Amanita species just like people, but the onset is faster, the syndrome is a little different, and they also eat a lot of weird little mushrooms that people generally ignore, like little Inosibi species that can be fatal to dogs as well.
Okay.
So it's a tough call.
Tough call. We're talking about mushrooms and other fungi. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Kathy Hodge, it's my understanding that this has been an incredibly good year, a fruitful year, a large year for mushroom hunters. Is that true?
Yes, very bountiful this year. We had a lovely wet summer here in the Northeast.
What are the conditions that are favorable for mushroom growth?
Well, wet is good for mushrooms. Mushrooms just depend on high humidity in the air just to disperse their spores. So you generally find them fruiting in wet times, high humidity, a lot of rain after storms. And this is one of those summers, boy.
Yeah. And what's the best time for people to look for mushrooms?
Well, it varies. It depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for morels, you better be looking in the spring because they don't grow any other time of year. And chanterelles may be midsummer, and each different mushroom species has its own fruiting pattern. So just about any time of year, there's something fruiting.
All right. And David Fisher, I wanted to come to you because you were saying that the cultivated, the button mushrooms, you know, those are ubiquitous. Why are there with so many hundreds of mushroom species and certainly many of them edible, why are there so few that are actually showing up in stores? I mean, your book describes many things that I've never seen before.
There are an increasing number of mushrooms showing up in some grocery stores and specialty grocers and specialty produce markets. Chanterelles, for example, here in Syracuse, you wouldn't have been able to find, you know, fresh chanterelles at the grocery store 20 years ago to save your life, dried ones perhaps. But now, during the season when chanterelles are fruiting prodigiously in the Pacific Northwest, we get lots of chanterelles from there, fresh in our stores.
Hmm. And is it possible? We were talking about this earlier at lunch today. Is it possible to grow your own mushrooms safely? I've heard that there might be kits that you can buy.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a colleague of Kathy's and mine, Paul Stamets, with a company called Fungi Perfecti. I don't know how many he's got at this point, but you can probably buy kits from his company for at least a dozen and maybe two dozen different edible species.
So really, you know, we've talked earlier today about brewing beer, now growing fungi. You know, we're actually providing this farm service for people. This is really excellent. Anyway, guys, thank you both very much for joining me this hour. It's been a fascinating glimpse at the fungal world.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, Kathy Hodge is Associate Professor of Mycology at Cornell University, and David Fisher is a mycologist and author of Edible Wild Mushrooms of North America. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Key Molesky, who insists that it's fungi, but she'll accept fungi. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teachers link on sciencefriday.com. Ira Flatow will be back in this chair. Well, not this chair, but he'll be back as the host of Science Friday next week. They'll be on the road in Tucson, Arizona. You should listen for that. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.